Good afternoon and welcome to Talk of the Towns. We try to go beyond the headlines to make sense of the issues facing Maine communities, to share what works, and to seek alternative solutions. Talk of the Towns has aired on WERU Community Radio since 1993, dedicated to the proposition that everyone benefits when we share our knowledge, our experience, our concerns, and our perspectives. We're about to practice the magic of community radio, in which those of us in our virtual studio and you who are listening create a dialogue that we hope will be of benefit to our friends, our neighbors, and colleagues. Liz Graves and I are your co-hosts. Liz is away this month and she'll return next month. We hope you'll stay with us for the next hour and Talk of the Towns. And just a reminder that we are recording this show in advance and won't be taking any calls today. Well, Cherryfield in Down East Maine has a long history tied to the Narragansett River, driving logs, water power for sawmills and blueberry canning, and its fisheries, including Atlantic salmon. A dam was constructed in 1961 to help reduce flooding, but it prevented fish from passing upstream to spawn. So today, we're going to hear about a 10-year effort to restore fish passage on the Narragansett through the efforts of the town of Cherryfield and leadership from Down East Salmon Federation and Maine Coast Heritage Trust. We're so happy to have some guests in our virtual studio. Jacob Vandesande is the Associate Director for Land Protection with Maine Coast Heritage Trust. Mary Knapp is a select board member in the town of Cherryfield. And Ellie Mason is a new project manager for Down East Salmon Federation. Welcome to you all. Jacob, a little introduction, please.
All right. Thanks, Ron. So, yes, I'm an associate director of land protection for Maine Coast Heritage Trust, and I work out of our Whiting office. And the focus of my work is Washington County. I split Washington County with Patrick Watson, who's another project manager. I'm a fisheries biologist by training, so that's why I've been so involved in the Narragansett and Orange Rivers. Maine Coast Heritage Trust was founded in 1970 on Mount Desert Island, but we are a statewide land conservation organization, so we work from Kittery to Lubeck. Historically, it's been pretty focused on coastal islands and the coast, but back in 2013, the organization realized that if we were really going to pursue the economic, cultural, and ecological sustainability of our coastal communities, we might need to look inland and look at rivers. And so in 2013, as part of that strategic plan, we started a rivers initiative and we looked at 36 rivers statewide, sort of on the coastal plain. We didn't take the big, huge rivers like Penobscot or Androscoggin. And we narrowed it down to five rivers in the end. And so we now do work on the Mousam, the Sheepscot, the Bagaduce, the Narragansett, and the Orange Rivers. And so when that initiative kicked off, you know, we saw challenges and opportunities that drew us to certain rivers. And the Narragansett, it was certainly the ice control dam. And so we, you know, in 2014, convened a group of partners, you know, everyone who was interested to discuss this issue. And everyone agreed that it was something that we needed to address and sort of kicked off a process that I think we'll talk about later in their interview.
Great. Ellie, could you introduce yourself a little bit and tell us more about the Down East Salmon Federation?
Yeah, thanks, Ron. My name is Ellie Mason, and I am the Habitat Restoration Project Manager at Down East Salmon Federation. I've been in this role just since September of last year, so still feeling pretty fresh to the work. But in that role, I manage several of Down East Salmon Federation's largest restoration projects, and that includes the removal of the Cherryfield Ice Control Dam that we're talking about today. And I think, you know, project manager is several things at Down East Salmon Federation. I do kind of a myriad of tasks. So I do a lot of scheduling, a lot of note-taking, facilitating. I'm really there to keep us on track with our timelines and juggle a lot of moving parts. And more recently, I've felt kind of like a stand-in historian in parts, just trying to dig into the history of some of these projects. And I kind of am here to take the projects through all of the different stages, from sort of conceptual to the design work to the actual implementation of whatever that restoration action might be. And so, you know, working for Down East Salmon Federation, the focus is really on sea run fish and restoring sea run fish populations in Down East Maine. And so the organization began in 1982 and was really sort of emerged from a lot of like local fishing and hunting clubs in the area that, you know, saw a need for being a voice for the rivers and for the fish. And so they sort of organically grassroots organized. And that was kind of the impetus for Downy Salmon Federation. And then after the listing of Atlantic salmon on the endangered species list in 2001, the land trust component of Downy Salmon Federation really began. So thinking pretty holistically about, you know, it's not just enough to protect the water, you also have to think about the land and the other things that influence fish habitat. So that's kind of a bit about Downy Salmon Federation. And we've always been connected to the Narragansett in some form or another. And that's been a big focal river for the organization. And so this project sort of came to be through being historically on the river, being involved in the community and caring about restoring sea run fish passage, especially the Atlantic salmon.
Well, Mary, you're currently a select board member in the town of Cherryfield, but I understand you've had a long history of being involved in the community. Tell us a little bit about yourself, and we'll ask more questions about the town of Cherryfield in a minute, but tell us a little bit how you got involved.
I've always lived in Cherryfield my whole life. Uh-huh. And my mother came across in 1959 as a Native American and met my dad on the Blueberry Barrens, and he lived here in Cherryfield. This is where his family was from. So we've always had deep roots here. And I have brothers that live here and other family members still that I take care of. I also belong to the Cherryfield Riverwalk Committee. And I wanted to get involved in the town so that we could get some of these projects moving forward. It's very important for us to get this river involved in our town and get some economic stuff involved with our town also. So when I was a younger girl, everybody used to come here as a teenager. When I was a teenager, they used to come here and fish for the Atlantic salmon. And they would line up and down the river and have all their fishing rods and take turns fishing. And it was just exciting to see. And then over the years, it's just dwindled out, especially when it became endangered. So it would be nice to bring back, you know, a lot of people enjoying the river like they used to. I think it's very important. And it's important to the town of Cherryfield, so we just don't fade away.
Right. So blueberries were important. You mentioned your parents and yourself involved in raking blueberries. What else was the past history of the town in terms of industry? I suppose logging and sawmills were on the river?
That's right. There was logging and sawmills, and there's a lot of pictures. I own quite a few buildings right here on the river in town, and there are pictures back when they used to have lumber piled up on the side of the river and the ships used to come up and get it and then, you know, take it to Europe and sell. They used to do a lot of blueberries here too, and a lot of the people would come in and rake blueberries and harvest blueberries. A lot of the Native Americans still came to do that until recently.
Right. And I think, like many other coastal towns, being at the junction between the ocean, the salt water, and yes, the fresh water, and having the ability to unload load products on boats, really important to those coastal towns.
Very important. And it's the history of our town that we're trying to save and get everybody to come back and see where we started and where we're going. And we really want to become a little hub again and let people come here and enjoy our town.
And how would you characterize the town now? Kind of the past is there. You know, it's there. You're looking for the future. How would you characterize Cherryfield now? Who makes up the population now, for instance?
We have a lot of elderly people here still, but I have seen in the past couple of years, a little influx of businesses starting up again. We have the public tennis courts. We have a lot of people that come to town for that, to play down here. This is probably one of the only tennis courts that was built back in the 90s that's still used quite a lot.
Retirees? You mentioned an older population. These are retired people for the most part?
Retired people, yes. I also sell real estate in this area, and we have had an influx of people. When a house comes on the market in Cherryfield, someone's here to grab it pretty quick.
Okay, yeah, good. Well, let's go back to Ellie and get a little bit more about the Downy Salmon Federation. You've described in general terms, but perhaps talk a little bit about the fish.
Yeah.
Tell us more about how that became the focus of an organization.
Yeah. So again, you know, like I mentioned, Downey Salmon Federation was founded back in 1982 and sort of rose up organically from sort of hunting and sporting fishing clubs that really sought to bring attention to Downey's rivers. I think at the time there was a lot of attention being focused in the Penobscot River system and not as much down east. And so these folks really self-organized to try and advocate for the rivers and for the fish. And at the time, you know, in the 80s, salmon populations were pretty good. And then we started to see a decline. And so that sort of, you know, created more of an energy and momentum around advocating for the rivers. And I, you know, salmon is in our name, but it's other species of sea run fish that Downey Salmon Federation also cares about, like river herring, alewives, and blueback herring and shad and lamprey. You know, there's a lot of other species that use that sort of go between that ocean system and that freshwater system, and that's sort of the focus of Downey Salmon Federation. And I think we take a pretty holistic approach, which holistic is a word, if you have an ecology background, that is used so much, it's kind of, it feels a bit meaningless sometimes to me. But I think I sort of think of that as, you know, multifaceted, looking at the whole fish, the whole system. So Downey Salmon Federation operates two different hatcheries that raise Atlantic salmon to be released in, you know, the local rivers here. And we also have a land trust, which conserves and protects land through various kind of mechanisms. And that land is really focused around rivers. So we try and focus our protection efforts on land that abuts rivers, that has an impact in the water system, in the watershed. And then we also have this sort of, you know, third component, which is this habitat restoration. So I think realizing it's not just enough to set aside the land and protect it, but there are also ways in which we can take an active role in restoring the lands and the waters to better benefit fish and fish populations. And, you know, salmon habitat isn't just the water. It's also shade cover from trees that grow up along the riverbanks, which is an area that we call the riparian zone. So it can be managing that zone for invasive species removal that could choke out essential native plants. It's thinking about pollutants and runoff into the stream beds. You know, ultimately everything flows into our waters. And so looking at the upland areas to make sure we're having adequate protection is really key to the success of our restoration goals. Yeah.
Great. Well, Jacob, I'm conscious of you as a biologist. Tell us a little bit more about the ecology of a river. What are the, Ellie's just mentioned many of the aspects, but in terms of fish passage, what do fish need in order to get upstream, and what's the purpose of them getting upstream?
Yeah, so the Narragansett River, for example, you know, for thousands of years since the glaciers retreated, since those rivers sort of settled in, anadromous fish were some of the first fish to colonize these rivers because they had the ability to swim out in the ocean in salt water. And so they come into these rivers, and over time they were colonized by, you know, myriad different species. And anadromous fish played a really important role. So an anadromous fish is a fish that spawns in fresh water but spends a portion of its life in the ocean. So they're able to, when they go out into the ocean, to feed out there and grow large and rapidly. Those populations can grow very large. And then they come back into the river and they spawn, spend a portion of their life in the river. And they provide a tremendous amount of nutrients and productivity to the system. So anyone who's been in Cherryfield when the alewives are running, I've seen a dozen eagles before in one location. The cormorants come, the otters, the seals are in the lower river. And so these anadromous fish, there was this exchange between the inland forest and the estuary and the ocean that really created this productivity that we saw, you know, when the colonists came here, you know, when Mary's ancestors were living here, it was a good place to live because there was, you know, at the mouth of these rivers, there was all this food. And so with the colonial period, the first thing that happened was the building of the dams. So when the colonists came, the first thing they did at that time, the only way to power any sort of industry, if you want to grind your grain, it's pretty hard just to do it by hand. And so they built dams. But very quickly in the 1600s in Massachusetts and in the 1700s in Eastern Maine, it was really clear to the people who were living there that the dams really interrupted that flow of fish and that productivity that fed them. And so there were rules created and they built fish ladders. And it's sort of interesting. I'm right here on the Orange River right now and working on a fish passage project there. But in 1867, Charles Atkins, who started Craigbrook National Fish Hatchery, wrote to Joshua Chamberlain, who was the governor of Maine after the Civil War, about the great restoration work that's happened on the Orange River. And so they built the fish ladder. You know, by the 1840s, people were really upset. The alewives weren't coming back. The salmon weren't coming back. They built the fish ladder and the fish returned in great numbers. And it was a great success. And so Charles Atkins, you know, in 1867 was saying, we really need to pay attention to this fish passage. But here we are in, you know, 2025, and there's currently no fish passage. Hopefully construction happens this year and we'll have fish passage on the Orange River. And the same is true on the Narragansett. There were multiple dams, and we can talk more about the history of the dam itself, maybe, I don't know, later in the program.
Well, I think that brings, I mean, so people were observing that the dams were interrupting the fish, and they looked to the fish for food. And so they knew that they were reducing their food source as a population because there were dams. So let's talk a little bit about the history of the ice removal dam in Cherryfield on the Narragansett. Jacob, you want to get us started about that in terms of when that dam went in, what's the history of the dam, why it existed, and then Mary may have some thoughts about that too in terms of flood control and so on. You get us started, Jacob.
Yeah, so there has been a dam on that site since, you know, the late 1700s, early 1800s. But in 1942, in the spring freshet, there was high water and it blew out the dam. And so it was part of it. There was an ice jam that came down a river. And after the dam blew out, the ice washed downstream and down below town. When you get into tidewater, the ice jammed up against the ice that was still there and it backed up and it flooded the downtown of Cherryfield. There's photographs of people rowing around in boats on Main Street and so on. And there was a series of floods over in the 40s and 50s in Cherryfield, ice jam related floods that happened that really raised some concern. The town ended up getting the Army Corps of Engineers involved. The initial study was inconclusive, but the town of Cherryfield said, hey, this is still happening, and they really pushed. And so the Army Corps of Engineers built an ice control dam. I don't know that there are any others of its type in the country. It's kind of unique. But essentially the idea in 1961, they built this dam that created a pond, a head pond upstream. And the idea is that ice would form on that head pond and the slow moving water in that pond would capture frazzle ice that was produced in the fall when you have rapid cooling and you get the slush flowing down river that can cause flooding. And then ice would form in the winter. And then when the spring freshet came, that ice would be trapped in that head pond and the ice would stay in place and it would protect the town. When that was happening, they designed it originally without any fish passage. And the Narragansett Salmon Association and the salmon anglers in Cherryfield really advocated very strongly for fish passage. So when they finally built it, they put a Danil fishway inside the structure. It works. Fish do pass. Like the salmon population is still there. But actually, when I started my career over 30 years ago, it was my job to watch a video camera of the dam to count the salmon that attempted to jump over the dam. So when salmon were ascending the river, you could see them trying to jump over the dam repeatedly. You could see them attempts, you know, individual fish dozens of times. We know that the shad really suffered in this Danil fishway. And you could see dead shad floating down river while you're shad fishing. And it certainly slowed down the alewives. And anecdotally, sea run brook trout were common in the Narragansett River. Salmon fishermen reported them. But once the dam was built, they really stopped seeing sea run brook trout. So it turns out that it's a real, real barrier to fish passage in the river. And it blocks 90% of the habitat in the Narragansett River, which is one of the most important Atlantic salmon rivers in the United States. So it's really significant.
Mary, do you have any recollections of the flooding that happened? Were you young enough to kind of, or old enough to understand what was happening in terms of the flooding that happened?
The flooding was happening before I was born.
Okay.
But I'm part of the historical society in town, and we have lots of photos of the flooding that happened in the 30s and the 40s. And people today are still bringing us pictures that they have in their collections that they took of when the flood was in town and the big ice cakes, as big as a car, was floating around. It was pretty amazing.
40 years later, after the dam is in place, it's controlling the flooding, but where people are recognizing that fish can't get up the river in great numbers. What led to the current effort that started about 10 years ago? I'm going to remind listeners who they're listening to. We're talking about a river story, Cherryfield and Fish Passage on the Narragansett here on Talk of the Towns. And we're joined by Mary Knapp, you just heard from. She is a select board member, a longtime resident of the town of Cherryfield. Ellie Mason is a project manager with Downey Salmon Federation, and Jacob Van de Sande is the associate director for land protection, focused on rivers a lot with Maine Coast Heritage Trust. So who wants to pick up the story in terms of looking at the ice dam? Jacob, you want to start?
So as I mentioned earlier, Maine Coast Heritage Trust had a rivers initiative, and we chose the Narragansett River. And basically the first action in that rivers initiative was to reach out to all the potential partners statewide and beyond, really, who were interested in the Narragansett River and had concerns about the ice control dam. So I think most or all of the select board members from the town of Cherryfield were there. NGO, you know, a lot of different NGOs, fisheries and land conservation organizations, state and federal agencies. So Department of Marine Resources manages the fish ladder and the fish counting on the river. But Inland Fish and Wildlife was there. National Marine Fisheries Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Army Corps of Engineers as co-owners of the dam. So it's a core structure. So when it was built, the Army Corps shared with the town of Cherryfield the ownership and responsibility for maintaining the dam for public safety. And so that was a key piece of this whole thing. You can't do anything to a structure that serves sort of public safety without working with the Army Corps of Engineers. But I was really surprised and pleased with the outcome. You know, people showed up and everyone agreed that it was an issue that needed to be addressed. And so the Department of Marine Resources, being the state agency that was most involved, wrote a letter to the Army Corps requesting a feasibility study to look at the ice control dam. And so through Section 1135 is a program to look at the environmental sustainability of core structures. And so that kicked off a 5 or 6 year process with the Army Corps of Engineers, where they looked at the dam and all the potential ways that we could improve fish passage on that dam. It was sort of a painful process. It took a really long time. It cost quite a bit of money. And in the end, the recommended outcome, the preferred alternative of all the partners in the Army Corps of Engineers, was to replace the current, which is a timber crib rock-filled dam, with a river width nature-like fishway, a rock ramp, as we call it, that will much more, it will do the same, it'll serve the same purpose. It'll hold back that pond behind the dam. You know, this new structure will hold back the water, but it'll look much more like a natural set of rapids and perform like a natural set of rapids to the fish. You know, they will have just downstream come up through rapids that are very similar to that. The challenge was, is this Section 1135 program potentially could have helped us fund it, but they thought that it was going to exceed the $10 million price tag that the program would allow to fund. They could have done a whole nother study, which would have taken a lot more time, probably another 10 years and a lot more money. It's expensive to do work with the Army Corps of Engineers. Their cost estimates were almost double what we're currently looking at for the construction. We needed to deauthorize the ice control dam. So as a core structure of public safety, it takes literally an act of Congress. So we worked with partners. And so I should take a step back, because the key to this whole project has been the partners. So the town of Cherryfield has been there from day one. The other key partners were the Atlantic Salmon Federation, the Nature Conservancy, and the Downey Salmon Federation. And so very early on in this process, the town of Cherryfield was interested in seeing this, but they recognized that they could not afford to do this work. Already just maintaining the dam was a challenge for the town. Those partners, Maine Coast Heritage Trust, the Nature Conservancy, the Atlantic Salmon Federation, Downey Salmon Federation, wrote a letter to the town of Cherryfield committing to supporting the town through this process, to ensuring improved fish passage, continuation of the alewife harvest, and that it wouldn't cost the town of Cherryfield any money. And so we wrote a letter, and that's been sort of the guiding, you know, moving forward. It has been those partners working with the town of Cherryfield to sort of see this project through. Nature Conservancy has great staff who work in Washington, D.C. and are very involved in lobbying down there and so on. And we were able to work with our House and Senate representatives to get a bill. But the first thing we needed was a vote from the town of Cherryfield. And we, November of 23, we pulled the town meeting together and the town voted to deauthorize the ice control dam. It was a unanimous vote. People, you know, it was a 10-year process. We've worked very closely with the town through this process, and people were ready and saw this as an opportunity. And there was no opposition, which is almost unprecedented in town meetings, and certainly in my experience, and multiple select board members there said the same thing.
I remember that meeting, and it was awesome to see the town to finally come together unanimously to accept this. It was great.
You were getting both. You were getting continued flood control, and you were getting fish passage, and you saw that as part of the future of the community.
Right. And economically, it was a great idea for our town because we never would have been able to afford to take care of this dam as life goes on here. It would just been way too much. Our townspeople could never have raised enough tax money to take care of this.
Sure. So, Jacob, you and the other members of the kind of coalition kind of pledged to make sure that Cherryfield could get out of this without having to come up with the tax dollars. So take us forward a little bit more, and then we'll hear more from Ellie.
It was, you know, things have not been easy in the House and the Senate in the past few years. But in December of 2024, the House voted on the Water Resources Development Act, which included two sentences deauthorizing the Cherryfield Ice Control Dam. Right. As this process was unfolding, the Down East Salmon Federation wrote a grant to the NOAA to conduct the design and construction of this project, and that is the role that Ellie's taken on. And so they were successful and received a $9.1 million grant. And I'll hand it to Ellie to talk about that process.
Great. Please, Ellie Mason, please go ahead with the description of your organization's role, Down East Salmon Federation, in this design of a facility. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I think, Jacob, I was just thinking about that act of Congress this past winter, and I had only been working in this position a couple months at that time, and I remember it like passing the House and then everyone waiting a couple days and being like, is it going to pass the Senate? We don't know. In the morning it passed the Senate, I woke up early and went for a run through Cherryfield and ended up at the dam, and I was like, this is so special to like be out here and see the dam on the morning that I'm like, oh, all the work that we're sort of doing and we have been planning for is now, you know, able to go through, because that really was kind of the holdup for all of the work that I manage. So, yeah, so that award, again, was awarded to Down East Salmon Federation before I began in this role, but I manage it now. And so what that has looked like is currently we're sort of in this design phase of the nature-like fishways. So what's going to go in place of this this dam is going to be a nature-like fishway. And nature-like can mean a lot of different things. And in our case, what we're sort of landing on is a couple of different ways for fish to pass. Actually, you know, an infinite number of ways for fish to pass within a couple of different design elements. So I work closely with Interfluve. They are the engineers, the contractors who are doing the actual design work for the fishway itself. And they, you know, we work closely together and they, you know, do the design work. They do studies. They're out in the field. They're surveying the substrate. They're surveying all components of the area so that they can make sure that the design work that they're putting forward is, you know, best reflective of the current conditions and where we would like to see the future conditions of the river go.
What do fish actually need in order to be successful? How would you characterize what they actually need?
That's a great question. I think, so there's a couple of different things that I think about, and some of them are the depth of the water and the slope at which they swim upriver, and also the speed at which the water is moving. So those are three sort of factors that I think about as being really critical. So you don't want to create a system that has, you know, steps that are too high for fish to get through. That's, you know, kind of what we're seeing now with the dam that has this big jump that a lot of the fish can't make. So you want something that has a more gradual slope. And then you also want areas that have a mix between slow moving water and faster moving water, because fish, you know, expend energy. And so you want to create these little pools where they can maybe rest for a bit. They can be more stationary before they start to continue their movement upstream. And also having some of that depth in there creates areas where it's harder for birds and other predators to get into the river and eat them, which, you know, that's a great part of the ecosystem. That's what we want to see, that food chain, food web system, but also you want to make sure you're having good survivability upstream as well. So speed of water, the height at which you're moving through the system, and the depth of that water are some key factors that we're looking at right now.
Something I would look for if I were swimming upstream.
Yeah. Yep.
Great. And so where do things stand now in terms of the design process?
Yeah, so a couple weeks ago, maybe a couple months ago at this point, we got our 60% design plans from Interfluve. And so the way a design works for these things is you sort of work through it in increments. So back in the fall, we had 30% designs, and then we've moved through, you know, a lot of critique, a lot of feedback on those designs from both our core team, from the town, from, you know, state and federal agencies. And then that feedback all sort of pushed us through to the 60% designs, which we received in March. And we're still going through some of that critique and feedback at the moment. And then we're moving towards, you know, 100% design by the fall, you know, October, November, and hoping to go out for bid for construction in the winter to set us up for actual construction of the fishway next summer season. So we're deep in the design phase, and that also includes a lot of community outreach. So we want to share what we're working with to get feedback from residents on what they'd like to see, and if there are ways to make it more accessible to the site, improvements we can make to the park nearby. And then we also are working through a lot of the permitting side of things, which is definitely a very complex component of any kind of project of this scale, but that, you know, currently it's just a lot of meetings. I am in a lot of meetings for this project with various agencies to make sure that whatever we're doing and proposing is permittable through all of the different regulatory measures that we have to sort of wade through.
Mary, as a member of the select board in Cherryfield, what kinds of questions have you heard from the community saying, okay, what do we need to do now? What are they thinking about? What are community members thinking about in terms of the new process?
So they have been having meetings about the dam and what's going to happen and how are the fish going to get up there. We've had lots of questions about, can we access the dam still? Can we get up there and enjoy the dam? There are people that put in and they'll canoe upriver and they'll come back down. I think that a lot of our townspeople really did do a lot of fishing there, and they enjoy the river themselves and just want to make sure that they can still get out and enjoy it even while this process is going on.
So as you describe people's use of the river, is that just people in Cherryfield or people coming as visitors to Cherryfield to use the Narragansett River?
We have some visitors, but nothing like we used to have 25, okay. 30 years ago.
Sure. Sure. So, Jacob, you described earlier to me that the process now is lots of small questions like Mary's talking about. Will there be access to the dam? Will there be restroom facilities? Those kinds of things. Tell us a little bit more about some of the questions that you are helping to resolve.
Yeah, I would say, first of all, it's you couldn't sort of understate the value of this place to the community of Cherryfield. Anyone who comes there, particularly this time of year when the alewife harvest is happening and people are shad fishing, how much activity there is. There's a constant cars coming and going and people stopping. It's such an integral part of the community. And one of the great things about this process is that we, from the beginning, we recognize the importance of it, and we've been able to incorporate it into the process. And ultimately, NOAA really understands that in order to make these advances around fish, we also need to address community and access. And so they allowed funding in our proposal to improve the park. Not only will they get the park stays there, but we hope that the park will be improved. And in fact, Janet Coit, who is the director of National Marine Fisheries Service, came for a tour, and we have a photograph of almost our entire select board, all these NGO partners, everyone standing there. And this is a woman who sees this work nationally, and she was just super impressed with Cherry Field and the community engagement and the opportunities created by this process. And part of it is the park. And so
describe, if you would, to our listeners, what's there now? What would you see if you drove up the road in this term, this notion of a park?
So you drive by the Cherry Field Foods, the old factory there, and you come up and you turn onto the Cable Pool Road. And the first thing you see actually is the Downey Sunrise Trail, which runs right. And there's an old train bridge that goes across the river that provides great views of the river. And then you continue on, and then you'll come to what is the Cable Pool, which, 30 years ago was a focal point of salmon fishing in Eastern Maine. There was a rod rack there where there was 12 slots, and you would go and you'd put your rod in the rack and wait your turn to fish down through the pool. And there's also a USGS gauging station there as well that you can go online and see the water level in the river. You go up around the corner and there's a loop there, and it's just below the dam is where people fish for shad. And so it's one of the few places in Eastern Maine where people really go shad fishing. It's very popular. So you can't fish for salmon anymore, but you can fish for shad. And so it's a great destination. Then you see the dam itself. And then above the dam, there's another loop and the town, the alewife harvest. So the town manages the alewife resource and leases it out for harvesting every year. And so you'll see trucks all lined up with their crates that they fill up with alewives for lobster bait, halibut bait. And it's just a spot where you can sit. There's a shelter with a picnic table. You can just sit and watch the river. A lot of people just come up just to sit and watch the river, to watch the eagles and the ospreys, the cormorants, watch the beavers and the goslings. It's just a beautiful spot, and people use it. There's also a boat ramp up above. I forgot about the boat ramp. And so that flat water that's created by the dam also creates a pond where, you can paddle upstream. It's not too much current, and it's a great recreational resource as well.
And I assume that this is not new. In other words, you mentioned some of the federal sources. These kind of natural passage fishways are being, they're in place elsewhere. So what do we know about what works? Jacob and then Ellie?
Yeah, in the scheme of things, these nature-like fishways are relatively new.
Okay.
But they have been installed in Maine with great success. One of the early ones was on Sajunkadunk Stream in Brewer that has shown to function really well. Another big one that got a lot of attention, and it was designed by the folks at Interflu for we're working with, is the Howland Bypass. So when they did the Penobscot project, the Howland Dam stayed in place, and they built a bypass around that looks like a natural river channel. But they're more using this more and more worldwide, and I think that it has really been embraced as a great solution to fish passage work, so much better than what we would call a technical fishway that's purely made out of concrete. At Ellie talked about, it's about the variety of different flows and depths and structures that really help the fish feel safe. When it's made out of concrete and there's square corners, the fish don't feel safe, and it doesn't offer the different velocities for fish of different sizes and swimming abilities. These nature-like fishways have really been a breakthrough, I think, in the world of fish passage.
Ellie, what have you learned in your time at Downey Salmon Federation managing this project? What have you learned about natural fishways that you haven't already told us?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have an engineering background, so I have learned huge amounts of things about the technical components of these kinds of things. And honestly, one of the biggest takeaways for me is never be afraid to ask your engineer a very technical question. That's what they're here for. So, terms that I don't understand, concepts, I'm trying to constantly learn and grow myself. And I think that's been a really interesting part of this job and getting to dig into more of that technical side of things. But in terms of fishways, I think, there's a concept that I remember learning about in graduate school or maybe even in college called biomimicry. And it's where humans try and mimic what's going on in the environment, to serve their functions, to serve their purposes. And I think this is kind of some type of version of that, where you're trying to mimic the natural river system in an engineered way in order to afford the best opportunity for fish to pass through the system. And so it's kind of like, we look downriver, we look upriver, we look at the system as a whole, and what do we see there that we can then put back in this place? Because again, the river that we're thinking about is a modern version of the Narragansett, and it existed in a free-flowing form, you know, way, way, way long ago. And, you know, we're hoping to have that happen, you know, on the other side of this, is to get a more organic, free-flowing river once more. So I think just thinking a lot about some of those technical components, things where you're trying to juggle like percentages. Does this percentage matter compared to this percentage of slope? And it's not always an easy answer. And I think that's the beauty of having a lot of different people at the table for a project like this, is you're getting a lot of different ideas and you're challenging sort of the norms that you might think of as being effective. And that's been such a great opportunity for me in this position, and something I've really enjoyed throughout the process.
Well, that speaks to the power of a coalition. Everybody comes into it. Jacob, you mentioned all the different organizations that were saying we agree on the goal, but they each came into this with some slightly different motives. And I suppose the coalition stands because you were able to work some of those details out. How would you describe the coalition now that Downey Salmon Federation has gotten this money? Where are the members of the coalition? How are they helping now, Jacob?
Yeah, we still meet at least monthly, if not more often. You know, we have our Zoom meetings with all of the partners, sort of, and Ellie does a great job of sort of creating lists and agenda items to really address the task at hand. We meet fairly regularly with the select board. Ellie and I just were at the select board meeting last night to talk about these details of the town park, and to talk about, so do you want to have trash cans or no trash cans? Are we going to have a pit toilet? Are we going to put porta potties? Are we going to have no toilets? And so really getting down into the nitty gritty, and that's where we really are, like getting down into the details of this process and having those meetings with the Army Corps of Engineers, with Inland Fish and Wildlife, with NOAA and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to talk about the permitting stuff. And then bringing the both the progress and the questions to the town of Cherryfield. I mean, the success of this project has been in large part due to the select board's willingness to participate and let us know who to talk to and when, and helping us pull together these meetings and the format. We've had great partners in this Cherryfield select board. They really have a vision for the future, and they've been great supporters. And that's why this project has been successful.
I'll just remind listeners, they're tuned to Talk of the Towns. We're talking about a river story, a great river story, Cherryfield and Fish Passage on the Narragansett River. Just heard from Jacob Vandesande, who is Associate Director for Land Protection at Maine Coast Heritage Trust. Also heard from Ellie Mason, the project manager at Downey Salmon Federation, managing this restoration of natural fish passage on the Narragansett River, and Mary Knapp, a select board member from the town of Cherryfield. Let's turn to the future. Mary, start with you. Imagine, a year from now, the construction is begun or is nearing completion, maybe 18 months from now. Everything's in place. How do you envision the town of Cherryfield celebrating this? And what do you see as the advantages to this kind of new way of managing fish passage and ice protection from ice buildup?
Well, I have all my confidence in Jacob and Ellie that this whole process is going to work the way it's supposed to work. But as a select person for the town, I am mostly concerned with the economic, that it's going to bring the economy to our town here. The tax base is something that we need to worry about, because we have so many people that are retired. And I think that with all the other organizations in town involved, that it's really going to open up what everybody can do here. You know, we have the Riverwalk Project. They're working on hiking paths for the young and the old, and some areas for handicapped to get to. And with this park, we'll have different seating areas. We'll have updated parks. We'll have the Historical Society. They're working on their building, and they're going to open up, and they're going to make, you know, another room, more things interested in having to do with the river. We're going to get our school involved. They'll be able to get the children down there and talk about the fishing and what used to happen and the eagles. You know, get them out in nature so they can enjoy that also. We'll have an uptick in businesses. You know, we have the coffee shop. We have some antique stores in town. We're getting ready to start working on Cherryfield Square, which will be a another community building that people can come to and have different things. So economically, I think this is going to be really good for our town and the fishermen. They'll be able to get out and see the salmon, and hopefully we'll get some things that we can get people out on the river a little bit more, like in the parks. They're talking about putting a little floating dock out. There's nothing like little kids out on the floating dock looking in the river and seeing the fish go upstream. Great. So I think that will be very important for our town, too.
Great. Jacob, it isn't always as easy to work with a community. Sometimes communities have real debates about what to do about a dam. And we don't need to mention other names, but Cherryfield seems unique in this process of looking to the river as its both its past and its future. How does that play out as you do work throughout the region?
Well, I mean, for starters, it takes time for, you know, for people to get used to change. And, you know, I think it takes in most communities, my experience is it takes like 10 years to work through this process and to really develop a process that works for everyone. I'd say two things about it. I think one, we have a select board that, you know, I've known a lot of these people for 30 years. And so we've built this relationship. This has really been a 30-year project for me. And it takes that kind of time to build those relationships. And then the other piece of this is that the town isn't really losing the pond behind. It's a little different in some, you know, in some situations we really are talking about a big change. This solution doesn't involve, you know, a taking away of the pond. So I think it did make it a little easier. But I really think it is a commitment on the part of the partners, the NGO partners. All four organizations are really committed to this work and realize the importance of working with communities to get this work done. And then, as I said, we have a select board who really has a vision for the future. They care. They're not holding on to the past. They want their communities to thrive into the future and are willing to take some risks. Mm. And they've all, you know, everyone has shared this around. All the select board members talk to the people, and we've had these, you know, community meetings, and we got a unanimous vote, and we're moving forward.
Great, Ellie. What more would you add to this notion of the future of this river system that you're taking care of as part of Down East Salmon Federation, the land above the dam, the land and river below? What would you say about the future?
Yeah, a couple weeks ago, I actually got to do a 19-mile canoe paddle on the Narragansett, where we ended at the Cable Pool Park. And I, you know, I have spent a lot of time in these past several months at the park itself, at the dam, and I see that area so much, but I hadn't seen a lot of the other stretches of the river. And so for me, I think getting to be out on the river helped me sort of frame how important this place is to people in this area. And every time I talk to somebody who lives in Cherryfield or who's fished on the river, it's a different connection to the place, and trying to hold those stories and hear the memories and think about how can I take that with me into these future looking plans. So, you know, it's everything from somebody who said, I really care about this specific tree in the area and want to show it to you and tell you about why I want to protect it and preserve it in the future plans for the Cable Pool Park, to somebody who has seen and observed the impact that shad are facing, you know, with the current dam structure. So to me, I think there's this real interesting place of storytelling and connectivity that I'm excited to see move forward as this project progresses. So it's connecting people to place, fish to fish, river section to river section. There's just so much about connectivity that feels really exciting to be a part of, and something that I'm really hoping you know, carries through as we work through this project. So it feels like it's just, I mean, definitely for me, the beginning of my story with the Narragansett. And I think that feels really exciting and special to both develop sort of my own personal connection, but also this work connection to the river. So I'm, you know, constantly learning, constantly thinking about the story of this place and what it might look like in the future.
Any particular recollections from your river journey?
Oh, so many.
You remember, yeah.
So many good ones. I think so, like, as somebody who, you know, went to graduate school for fisheries research, you hear a lot about what makes a good salmon habitat. And then I've heard everyone here say, it's critical salmon habitat. This is the best river. And then paddling it, I kept on noticing the substrate on the bottom of the river and thinking, like, this would be a perfect place for a salmon nest, a red. Like, you could lay eggs here. This, like, hill slope is, like, so conducive to riparian zone protection. Like, it was just seeing all of the things that I knew to be true were true, like, when I saw them myself. And I think it's just a fun place to get to be and to be outside. And so much wildlife, you know, little middens of different shells from little critters that are, you know, eating and making their homes along the river, deer everywhere. We paddled by a smolt trap that was in the water that DMR was managing. And so it was interesting to see the research equipment from the perspective of someone paddling it. So
what's
you just
smolt?
Got this.
That's a smolt.
Yeah, a smolt. So a smolt trap is a trap that the state will put in the river, and it catches the smolts, the salmon smolts that are coming, you know, down river. And so it's a way for them to collect data on fish in the river, but they put them in the spring. And so when I paddled it this past spring, there was a big sign that said, watch out for the research equipment, paddle river left. And so you're interacting with the place in a different way than you do when you're sitting at your computer thinking about the design plans for the fishway. And it was really great for me to be out and see it and experience it in real time.
So we talked a little bit about early on, Jacob, that it's important for fish, especially salmon, to get upstream to spawn, but somebody needs to go downstream as well. And that's what Ellie is talking about there. So there's a recent book I haven't read. I must admit I haven't gotten it yet. I think it's called The Living River or River Living by Robert McFarlane. And so it strikes me as that all of you are talking about a living river, a river that has soul as well as human values to humans. Perhaps, Mary, you could reflect on that. Does this river have a soul? Is it a living river for you?
Oh, it is. Yes. So many people are they're just involved in the river. They're involved with the LY fishing. There are so many people here that have been here since I was a little girl who still come to town on the weekends and go up and go shad fishing or looking for fiddleheads along the side of the river. You know, there's so many people here that really want us to succeed with this. And we really need to thank the Maine Heritage Trust and the Salmon Association and the other select board members for all getting on board and trying to get us to that goal.
And if we were thinking of our listeners as members of other towns, it might be having questions about their river, their natural resources. What advice would you give other select boards, Mary? And then we'll ask Ellie and Jacob the same kind of question. What would your advice be to other select board members in other towns about a process like this?
Well, I don't think that we as a select board just made this decision ourselves. We made this decision by talking to other people in the town. And you really need to get out and you need to talk to everybody that's here and see what's important to them. And so many people thought that this river and saving the dam or changing the dam at this, you know, where we are now was really important for the fish.
Right.
Not only the fish, but the eagles and the birds and the other wildlife that we have in town.
Right. Ellie, what would you say other communities might learn from this process in Cherryfield on the Narragansett River?
Yeah, I think one of my biggest takeaways is consistency and reliability can go a really long way. So, you know, as an organization, Downey Salmon Federation is ingrained in communities, you know, in Washington County and some in Hancock County as well. But it's showing up consistently. It's, you know, supporting efforts that are happening maybe adjacent to the one you'd like to see done. I think there's a lot of transferability in Down East Maine across projects. And so there's opportunities, I think, to engage in stuff that's active. And then that can snowball into something that maybe was stale for a bit that you would like to see momentum in. So I think it's worth it to just invest across a variety of different opportunities, because not everything's going to move at the same pace. And often you start having one conversation about something like fish passage in one community, and it's actually really relevant to another where maybe there's some more resistance. So there's ways to sort of, like, I already think about how this project is informing some of my other projects that are not moving this direction as collectively, cohesively as this one is. So I think it's great to just sort of show up consistently, show up reliably, and, you know, put your best foot forward and assume good intention and be open to having some of those hard conversations, because oftentimes that's where you realize that there maybe isn't as much conflict as you think there is, and there's ways to compromise.
Right. And talking about consistency, your leader, Dwayne Shaw, certainly has been consistent over the life of his career.
Yeah.
Focused on these kinds of issues. Jacob, what would you suggest might be a lesson or lessons for other communities facing similar kinds of concerns about a river and its place in the community?
I guess I would offer that I think, you know, certainly in rural Maine, many of these communities, the select boards are all volunteer. Their budgets are very tight, and they're overwhelmed by these kind of issues. You know, so that dam is, you know, is 60 plus years old, and it's failing, and the town didn't know how they were going to deal with it. So I would say, you know, I think that there are folks who may not think that they're in alignment with conservation organizations, with land trusts or fisheries focused organizations. But I would say that there's a lot of organizations that are out there and would like to support these communities in doing this hard work. We don't have, you know, clearly my goal in this process was improved fish passage. But what that looks like, we didn't know at the beginning. And it's been a process. We went through a whole process with the Army Corps of Engineers and the community to really look what the options are. I think people think that it's either stays the same or it's gone. But there's actually a whole range of things that are in between. And if we work together as partners and, you know, build those relationships, that there's real opportunities to sort of to make change in a positive way.
Great.
And we bring resources to the table.
Great. Well, we've come to the end of a very short hour. Be sure and join us from 4 to 5 on the second Wednesday afternoon of each month for Talk of the Towns. Podcasts of our programs can be found in the archive section of the WERU website. If you have comments or suggestions for future topics, please email us news@weru.org. Our theme music is a medley from Coronach on a Balnane House Highland Music recording. Thanks so much to our guests in the studio, our virtual studio today, as we told the story about Cherryfield and fish passage on the Narragansett. We were joined by Jacob Vandesande, Associate Director of Land Protection for Land Protection, Maine Coast Heritage Trust. Mary Knapp is a member of the Select Board in the town of Cherryfield, and Ellie Mason is a project manager with Down East Salmon Federation. Thanks to our underwriters, thanks to Joel Mann for engineering our program, and to College of the Atlantic for production help. Stay tuned for Ralph Nader Radio from 5 to 6 and 2 hours of jazz on Groove Shop from 6 to 8. Liz Graves and I are producers and hosts for Talk of the Towns. This is Ron Beard wishing you a good afternoon.